Good morning, everybody. Last week we interrupted exercise 3-6 because I had the feeling mainly I was giving some kind of lecture about it, and it was not mainly you doing some work of your own. So I ask you to give it a closer look. And maybe we just restart from the beginning. So some alternatives I pointed out last week. Which other alternatives did you think about? What came to your mind?
Okay, please. I think that, for example, if we would like, if we need some keys for exchange information between two participants, to secure our message, we should use symmetric cryptography because it's. I think that it's easy and it takes not so much time as when we use asymmetric cryptography, and maybe it's more powerful. And I think so. But for example, if we need, but we need to. Give the same key, the same symmetric key to two participants. For this case, we should use asymmetric cryptography because asymmetric cryptography maybe it's really more difficult to for third person who would like to understand our communication, to it's really more difficult for him to break our communication, to break this message when we use asymmetric cryptography. But it takes more researches. That's why it's really difficult. It's really complicated to. To secure the big messages, it's.
So mainly you are say, hey, symmetric cryptography is more efficient. So, if you want to encrypt long messages or many bytes, we should use symmetric cryptography if possible.
Yeah.
With respect to key exchange. Usually people say, hey, it's only keys, so it's, if you ignore the one-time pad for the moment, then exchanging key means exchanging a few hundred bytes. So computational expense does not matter too much. So I think the point you raised is an important point in the end, what keys are we going to use? But maybe if we start about key exchange, for example, we could exchange asymmetric keys and use them to later on exchange symmetric ones. We'll come to that. It's called hybrid encryption. So this is one way to do it. And secondly, of course, your argument doesn't tell us something. Should we use symmetric or asymmetric crypto to secure the key exchange itself?
I think we have to use symmetric or asymmetric cryptography for to secure symmetric keys.
Okay, why? Why wouldn't you use asymmetric keys for securing symmetric ones?
Asymmetric for asymmetric.
So my question was just to write it on the board, not to forget it. We want, or you want, for efficiency reasons, finally to have symmetric. And my question is, why not exchange symmetric keys using asymmetric crypto? So this is the question. And Any idea? Any arguments? And still I would urge you, let's discuss about security mainly. Because usually key exchange, it's not taking place too often. It's not involving too lengthy files. So mainly it should be a security issue. And please remember, we argued that what you achieve by security won't get better than the security of the key exchange. So security should be an issue. So how would you argue? Okay, maybe I go to the slides and try. So this was one of the graphics where I asked, hey, could you please have a look at it and start working with a plain piece of paper. And what we had here was a distinction between information theoretic security and cryptographically strong or only well analyzed. So what's the difference here? What's the difference between information theoretic and cryptographically strong?
You would practically never know whether the text you just deciphered is the one you wanted to decipher, because the one-time pad could also bring me another text, and I don't know if this other text is the one I just wanted to decipher. And so even if the attacker can try all possible one-time pads at a time and not take any time for this at all, then he wouldn't just know whether the text he decrypted is the one I send. And that's what makes this strong. While cryptographically strong just assumes that an attack would take quite a long time, and so it is not feasible for most entities. So it's quite strong by just assuming that no one has the time to do the attack.
Mm-hmm. So in short, if you can use information theoretic security, no need to care about the computing power of the attacker. No need to care about the algorithmic knowledge of the attacker. So if you can do it that way, life gets much easier for us. So if you start that way, we would argue, hey, we should use symmetric cryptography to secure the key exchange, because we make fundamentally less assumptions about the attacker. In some sense, of course, this argument is true. The argument as I phrased it, of course, is true. But in practice, what is the downside of using symmetric encryption, symmetric cryptography for key exchange? I would say, and what's the problem with that?
Hello. Yeah. If we are talking about key exchange, then we have no keys initially exchanged, and we have to start.
Whether we do it symmetrically or asymmetrically, all key exchange protocols assume that somehow, by a different medium, some keys already are exchanged. Of course, somehow this has to be done, and if you're now talking about key exchange in a very fundamental sense, then we have to talk about a two-phase protocol. So in the first phase, people might travel, people might meet other people, we might have some organizational issues, okay. Let's assume this is one phase, and then we have a second phase where people really want to communicate securely and want to establish some knowledge about particular keys on the spot, usually using the communication medium for key exchange they later on will use for exchanging messages. So assume we have the two phases, and now we are discussing how to organize that In the first phase, are you going to exchange manually long, long, long symmetric keys? Are you in the first phase exchanging public keys? So what kind of infrastructure are you building in the first phase? And of course, depending on what you did in the first phase, how are you going to use it in the second phase? So your argument you gave mainly said, hey, in the second phase, I would like to end up with symmetric keys sooner or later, because for bulk encryption, I need this. And I'm mainly interested in starting, hey, how do we start with? Because usually, if you want to arrive here, this can be decided later. The first phase is the phase with which costs us a lot of time and money, traveling, meeting people, setting up some kind of organizational issues. So usually here we really have to think about what we do, because changing that later on really is expensive in terms of travel, of time, and so on and so forth. So would you start mainly exchanging symmetric keys? Would you start mainly exchanging asymmetric keys? Would you exchange both, because you are traveling anyway, and it doesn't matter whether you're traveling with one key on your USB stick or with two keys? It doesn't make traveling much more expensive or much more cumbersome. So what would you do, and what would be your arguments for doing it? So maybe we go over there. So there should be two mics somewhere.
I would probably exchange both, because both have its pros and its cons. If you exchange the symmetric keys, and especially if you want them information theoretic secure, then you just need a one-time pad, and as it says, you can just use it one time. And so if you exchange this key, you can only use one key for one time, and you just can transmit a limited amount of keys by traveling. It's just this way. And
yes, but if I take, let's say, on my USB stick, 16 gigabyte of random numbers, and I give it over to you, then probably this is enough for a lifetime for the two of us, right?
Well, okay, I have nothing to say against this. That's right.
So surely one key does, even for the one-time pad, not mean just one encryption and that's it. A gigabyte, it's an awful amount of data.
Well, okay. I would have to say just exchange the symmetric keys, and you would be set.
Okay, so your argument would be, okay, we are exchanging symmetric keys, really long symmetric key, and that's it, right?
Yes.
Okay. Who wants to argue against that? And say this alone wouldn't be enough, because, and now we need some arguments. Do you want to try?
Yeah. I would think it's a very good idea at least to transmit some asymmetric keys, because if you have them exchanged, you can really be sure that the key you have received is the key of the person you just met. And
you will be sure that the random numbers he gets from me are my random numbers.
Yeah, okay, but it is a really good feeling to know for sure you have the right asymmetric key. So if you receive, for example, a signed message.
Okay, so of course now it's an argument, I feel better if I do it that way, okay? Okay, if you feel better doing it that way, do it. Because feeling better usually is a nice thing. But why do you feel better?
I think for practical reasons.
What are the practical reasons?
Okay,
I would argue, yeah. Of course, in some sense, your feeling is okay. But in the meantime, probably you got lost. what we are really talking about. Because we discussed we are exchanging a key. Now your feeling was, hey, if you have a long key, everything is fine. How could I argue against that, right? So mainly you had the feeling we are exchanging this symmetric key you would like to have in the end. But we are talking about the very early phase of key exchange, key distribution. So probably if we are exchanging keys, one of us is a key exchange center. So the long key we are exchanging probably is not mainly meant to encrypt messages, but to help, let's assume he is a key exchange center. If you're traveling to him and exchanging a long key as well, then he might use parts of these two long keys to route a symmetric key either from me to you or from you to me, or maybe he generates it, he routes it to the two of us, and then finally we both have a symmetric key without ever meeting. So, and in this scenario, probably now you will find arguments, what is the downside of this approach? Right? What is the downside? What makes you feel unhappy?
I just thought it would be a very good idea to have asymmetric cryptography possible in the long run. Because, for example, if you sign a message, this can, in some situations, be just what you want to exchange a message.
Okay.
But you can build such systems in a symmetric way. So if you really exchange,
okay,
pairwise.
Now your feeling comes down to, hey, this is nice for encryption, but for authentication, it really depends whether it's only authenticating the messages between two parties, no third parties ever involved, then it would be fine as well. If you want to have something like the rule of law, legal certainty, that you can prove to a third party what happened, then symmetric cryptography is bad. So then, in the end, exchanging a symmetric key for the end user is not enough. You may need a digital signature system in some applications. So in the end, for some application, you need asymmetric keys for functionality. Okay, so this could be one argument, but okay, let's assume at the moment in the end we want to arrive at a symmetric key. So your argument is okay, but it distracts us from the problems in the very beginning. So how would you argue? Maybe you have an argument? Just mute it. So it probably it's muted if you...
Yeah. If he's the trust center, you do not want to give your symmetric key to him because he will be able to read all your messages. I think you would give your public key to him, and then he would send to everyone you want to communicate with, so you could send, then the you could exchange the symmetric key.
Okay, so the downside is, in some sense, using symmetric cryptography, we have to believe, we have to trust in, that at least one of the senders we are using keeps the secret. If all of them, let's assume we are not just using one person or one organization, maybe you use 5 of them or 10, still you trust that not all of them will give away the key, right? And now, of course, it depends on your feelings. Are you more willing to trust that, let's say, 5 centers or 10 centers won't cooperate? So do you trust in a kind of organizational setting? Or do you trust that if an asymmetric crypto system will be broken, I will get to know it early enough. Whereas if the 10 centers cooperate, probably I will never ever get to know. And in this sense, you can't really compare it. Because I can't argue, hey, your argument is more reasonable than your argument. It's different kinds of things. Do apples taste better than cherries? Hard to argue. If you like to have apples, buy apples. So, of course, to start with, there might be arguments to start with symmetric keys because we much better understand the security of the crypto systems. But then we have to trust that key exchange centers don't attack, at least that not all of them attack. And we know that if they attack, probably we won't learn that, because no change in the system. Keys are distributed in the normal way. So how to detect that? With the asymmetric cryptography, if you start there, either someone had to break the asymmetric cryptography, which by enough computing power, by knowing better about algorithms, might happen, or that person, that sender, has to attack by giving the wrong keys. That is, it has to launch a modifying attack, which in principle we might detect. So quite different arguments, quite different scenarios. And now, of course, probably in the meantime, you know me, if I get two solutions which are really different, of course it's me thinking about, can we combine them in a way that we achieve the goodies of both? Of course, combinations, combining the disadvantages, okay, this is not what I'm really interested in. And so, exercise part D is an exercise, can we combine the two approaches? So, security is increased. Of course, the downside is, it's a little bit more expensive. So, maybe in the beginning, we have to exchange more keys. Maybe the protocol gets slightly more complicated. So, but it boils down to, hey, can we combine symmetric and asymmetric cryptography in key exchange in a way that the resulting protocol achieves better security? Okay, so now probably I would hope the motivation is clear. Whether the phrasing with respect to language is the best way, okay, I tried hard, but... So I'm looking for a protocol where if any of two situations arises, it's still secure. One situation is key exchange centers give away all the information they have. This breaks all symmetric cryptography. And the other situation would be that I trust in organizational issues. I trust that at least one of the centers is trustworthy. But all the cryptography which can be broken in principle is broken. So can we still then have a protocol working in that scenario? Now you may say, hey, this is a protocol for paranoids. Yes, okay, maybe. But I think we are here to think, how far can we stretch it? And maybe for some application it's needed, for other application it's not needed. But you should know whether it exists, and if it exists, how it works. So, I hope the problem is now clear. Any idea how to solve it? How would you look for a solution? Or how can you infer some properties of a solution?
So I have a proposal. We could encrypt the key that should be exchanged with an asymmetric system and encrypt that again with a symmetric system, such that an attacker who wiretaps the line, can, if he can break the symmetric system, then hopefully he can't break the asymmetric system. And if he can break an asymmetric system and not a symmetric system, he still cannot do anything about it. And I have a ability to check. Maybe we should still sign that package also, so that I, when I receive the package, I can check if it is really the unmodified package the Trust Center wanted to send me, and then I decrypt the symmetric system and the asymmetric system. Yeah.
Okay. The person behind you wanted to make a proposal as well.
I guess I would do it the other way around, to exchange it with some asymmetric keys for both sides. And then I take my message, my plain text, encrypted with an already exchanged symmetric key, and then encrypt it again with my private key, so the other party can at first check with their public key, my public key, that it is my message, and afterwards they can decrypt it with the symmetric key that it already has been exchanged.
Okay. It might well be that if you go into more details, that both of your approaches will work out in the end. Maybe. I'm not sure. I didn't do it the way you describe it. I started in the exemplary solution with, hey, in the end, we are going to add up many keys. So mainly, let's see it here. We are going to exchange different keys, different symmetric keys, and finally make up the final key we are going to use as a sum of symmetric keys. Because I would argue, if the system, in one of the two possibilities, should be secure in a scenario where all cryptography which can be broken in principle is broken, then all we have is symmetric cryptography in the end. So it's about exchanging a symmetric key. And my feeling is, if we start with using the different cryptosystems for key exchange on parts of the key, parts means of this part, this, that part, that part, then it gives us more flexibility, because you can all that do all that kind of stuff in parallel. Whereas if you are starting to encrypt your message, then you have to specify some kind of sequence. So usually it's more flexible if you are working on intermediate values, keys, or preliminary keys. You can generate whenever you want to and store them later on. And if the message you want to work on arises, then it goes fast. So I thought about it differently. The common idea between your approaches and my approaches is, of course, some of these keys here I have to work on in a symmetric fashion, and some of these I have to encrypt in an asymmetric fashion. So I hope that if one of the two possibilities is broken, then still at least one kind of preliminary key is still kept secret. And this secret then protects the overall sum. So this is the idea of the protocol. Okay.
Either the attacker has unlimited computational power, or all your exchange centers are going to cooperate with him, right? If your exchange centers cooperate with him, he will have all the keys.
Maybe your formulation wasn't right. What I assume is either the attacker can break all crypto systems.
Okay.
But then at least one key exchange centers won't cooperate.
Okay.
Or all of the centers are going to cooperate in the sense that helping in an observing attack, giving to the attacker all the secrets. But in this situation, the attacker can't break the asymmetric cryptography.
Yeah, but in the second situation, he will have all the keys once the key exchange centers give all the secrets, right?
No. Because, for example, I just go to the asymmetric stuff. Let's assume we are doing, besides many other things, this kind of key exchange. Then the end participants get to learn the public key of the other.
Yeah.
And then this they might use for encrypting between the two of them a symmetric key, a partial symmetric key, which gets part of this sum, so part of this key. So the different branches of the protocol probably are working between different actors. So if I argue that we are going to exchange symmetric keys here, not all of them shall be routed through these key exchange centers. Otherwise, your argument is fully true that then you can break it that way. So in some sense, now we can derive that at least one of the subkeys has to be exchanged directly between the participants A and B.
Okay.
Okay. And now I would argue now we are really in the issue of key exchange. Because now you should see, hey, it gets interesting. We can achieve more than what usually is believed we can achieve. So, okay, my small exercise, my small test, how many people have been prepared, how well, okay. It makes me slightly skeptical, but okay, it was only a small sample, so I may be completely misled. But if my assumption is true, then I really would urge you, for example, to work on part D. Now you've got some ideas. So it should be easier than in the beginning. Take a plain piece of paper and try to write out down the problem as you understood it, and write down the solution, how you derive it. And then maybe you sit together with your colleagues and discuss whether it works, your solution, whether it don't work, you improve it. And maybe, if you like, next week, you show up and if you still have some problems, you tell us. But I would really ask you to do it. My feeling would have been, with half of the people I asked, what did you prepare for today? My feeling is, if you go prepared like this in an oral examination, it will be a disaster for both of us. It's not the kind of emotions I want to have. So please, work on it and ask questions. In some sense, everything here sounds very simple till here, right? But if we are arguing, what kinds of keys are we finally exchanging? For what purpose? What are we using for it? Why are we using it for it? What are the arguments? Then you see, hey, it's not so easy. You should experiment with it. You should get used to it. And then you can stand it. But if you only listen here and never try, and in the oral examination for the first time, you really have to try, then this gets kind of a shock for you. And I'm not happy if it gets a shock for you. I'm much more happy if you keep everything under control and if both parties enjoy the examination. This is much more fun, really. Okay? So overall, my feeling is just to give you my expectation. I would assume that what we just discussed as the solution, what should I say? I would believe that 5 to 10 people in this room now are really prepared to do an examination about that. For the rest of you, I would have the feeling that starting with a plain piece of paper would be an extremely good idea in doing it. And if I would have been in your position as a student, I would have thought, I'm not taking the risk. I'm taking a piece of paper and I try it. The argument, more risk, more fun. It may be nice if you do base jumping or if you go to the mountains, but more risk, more fun in an oral examination, I would say it's a silly slogan. Let's go to part E. Did anybody try that? And what kind of problems we came across here? So it's about if we are doing symmetric key exchange, what about modifying a text? And to remind you, we had this kind of scenario, and I argued the more key exchange centers we take, the more security we gain, right? Okay, in some sense, yes, true. Surely true if you are talking about observing a text. The more centers you take, the more security you get, right? But what happens if any of the centers does a modifying attack? What might it achieve that way? Do you see the problem? A modifying attack would be one of the senders hands out two different keys. For example, if Y is the center cheating, then K2 here and K2 here could be different bit strings. What would this mean? Yes?
But so if you only use this one center that modifies, then essentially you encrypt a message that just the center can decrypt, so you just lose your confidentiality.
So first of all, with respect to confidentiality, we could argue no problem. It just means that A and B can't communicate. And now I would say the argument I just said in practice is a really silly argument. If A and B want to communicate, and if it doesn't work using encryption, what are they going to do? Okay, most people then send plain text. So a modifying attack is not really silly. If, let's say, I argued whoever wants to take part in key exchange, we should take it. Maybe this is the NSA, this is Mossad, this is the Roman Catholic Church, whatever. So take anybody who wants to give service to the community. This was my argument a few weeks ago. But now we could say, hey, if one of the key exchange centers is modifying keys, it has a kind of approach forcing people, or at least pressing people, towards sending plain text, which may be tempting for organizations like Mossad or NSA, and I'm even not sure whether the Roman Catholic Church is really in favor of encryption. I don't know. Never talked about that with them, so I don't know.
Maybe it's possible to single out which key is modified, because we know one key was modified, so we can check with some message that is unimportant if they decipher it. We can just use one key, we can check every single key with one message, so we will find out which key is modified.
You could say if you take all the three centers, it doesn't work out. So let's test them individually. Okay, so let's ask X, please exchange a key. Will work, right? You ask Y, please exchange a key for not so important. This is a test case, just for that. And now Y will behave properly. So in some sense, whenever you come up with a kind of two-phase protocol, hey, we want some security to hold if it's important, and if it doesn't work out, then we do some test phases. If the attacker isn't too silly, he will make the distinction between the two phases, and in one of them he will attack, and the other we will behave properly.
But I already have the keys, so I can already use the keys I have and check which of these keys was modified.
Okay. Nice idea. Good idea. So A and B say, hey, it didn't work out. If the message we did send is not really sensitive, then we could just exchange all the keys. Of course, if the message we wanted to protect is sensitive, then exchanging all the keys in public is not really a good approach, because it now would mean that the attacker gets to learn the message. So in some sense, we need a better approach. We need in some sense to get some protocol which gives us nearly certainty that the key values are the same before encrypting a sensitive message. Of course, if we have the feeling that the message we just tried out was only a test message, so in some sense it was a trap, then A and B can exchange K1 here, compare, K2, compare, and see, hey, it's Y. Sure?
Oh.
Are you now sure that it's Y? If A and B come up with different keys, K2, or could it be differently? Any clue how to argue here? Of course, if A and B are completely honest and they come up with different keys here, and if we assume that the communication channel from here to there, as well as the communication channel from here to there, are protected with respect to integrity, that is, we have some kind of authentication, which is not shown here in the graphics. So assuming all that, then we would know, okay, it's Y. But in practice, assume you are participant A. You have exchanged keys with X, Y, and Z. You're communicating with some participant B. Maybe you don't know much about B. You encounter some problems. And then with B you execute some protocol, and the outcome of the protocol is, if B is honest, Y is lying. But there's an alternative. B is lying, and maybe Y is honest. Of course, it could be that both are lying, but okay. So what would you do? Would you, you made three trips, one to X, one to Y, one to Z. Would you just abolish 1/3 of your expense in exchanging keys just because one participant B argues that one of the centers was cheating? Maybe a bad deal. So the problem is, in some sense, obviously it didn't work, but you don't know whether it was B or one of the centers. And this is something you would like to know before you just say, hey, and it's Y, and I never will use the services of Y again. So two persons.
Yeah, I could recheck it with another participant. For example, participant C, and use the same centers, and if the communication works, it don't depends on the centers. Okay. But it's not not all clear. So maybe you have several participants, and you use a different combination of key exchanging centers for each participant. So if there is an error during the connection with participant B and participant C and participant epsilon, so you can combine it and see what are the partaking key exchange centers and minimize the group of exchange centers I have to test if they are trustworthy.
The problem with your approach is that, of course, Y gets to know exchanging keys with A and B, or in an alternative, it may exchange keys with A and some C. And now let's assume this is the NSA. Why is the NSA? And maybe the NSA is expecting B to be a terrorist. Then in this particular situation, Y will issue two inconsistent keys just to cause A and B to converse in plain text. Now, if I follow your proposal, if I'm using some C, which may be mainly a honest person, because my firm belief is that even the NSA doesn't consider the majority of citizens to be terrorists. So, okay. So usually it will be just an innocent citizen or some innocent party. So why has no motivation to distribute inconsistent keys there? So what would we have then in the end? Y behaves properly. Can participant A be then sure that B did make all the trouble? Oh, still not. So you see now it's really difficult. And the problem I'm just discussing with respect to key exchange, in some sense, is a much, much more fundamental problem in any distributed system. If any two parties doing something with each other have difficulty finding out whether they have problems with each other or whether they have problems with their infrastructure, and this is not really possible to make a distinction of the two cases, then it gets a problem. Sooner or later. And this is a problem with the symmetric keys, which, again, you started with the discussion, hey, I like more asymmetric cryptography. I have a better feeling if we are using that, right? Your feeling is completely okay. Now you have still another argument why you feel like this. Because if it would be exchanging asymmetric keys, the keys would be signed usually. If you're now looking at this protocol and you have all that in the back of your head, you would say, hey, what would I do here? I argued that what we need is symmetric authentication from here to there and symmetric authentication from there to here. Now you could come up and say, hey, what I would like to have is digital signatures from here to there and digital signatures from here to there, then, assuming the digital signatures aren't broken, then A and B could prove to each other what key K1, what key K2, what key K3 they really got. And so we could use digital signatures to find out what really happened. Of course, only on the assumption that the digital signatures can't be broken. So again, for the protocol we had in part, I think it was D before, where we wanted to combine the two, now it gets really tough. Because in one of the two situations, you can't rely on digital signatures to find out if someone did a modifying attack. So in some sense, probably the solution you find, the exemplary solution, is only a solution against observing attacks. Probably it doesn't cover all kinds of modifying attacks. And now, just one minute, and again I would say, in some sense, key exchange is an old story. Probably you had the feeling when we started into that field, nothing really interesting. And still I would argue, if someone would do a complete solution to part D, complete, even against modifying attacks, either complete in the sense we solve it, or complete in the sense you have really strong arguments that this particular thing can't be solved in this particular scenario, then I still would argue this is a PhD thesis. Just to give you a feeling, when we get from doing nice exercises here, getting to the real research where nobody knows it. So, again, and now to set the level of expectation for the oral examination, what I expect is you are able to show that you are going to understand the problems and in some sense you can work on them. I don't expect that I ask you for a particular combination, solving a particular problem, and then you give me the complete solution for a very difficult problem. No. This would be a completely unreasonable expectation from my point of view. Okay. But still I expect you to have some experience, to have something tried out, and to show that you understood what the problems are, and that you tried out a few possibilities and are able to do an analysis what are the advantages and disadvantages on the way you tried to solve it. Okay, now it's your turn.
So I was still with concerned with the problem that why did a modifying attack and why gave two different keys to A and B? And if A and B have a system where they can check which key was the one they got wrong without letting the outer world know which of the how these keys were, they should not transmit them in plain text. Maybe they should encrypt K2 with K1 and K3 because it's the and try in a way like this to find out which key was wrong. But if they found out, if A knows B got a different key from Y than I got, then the only solutions I think they have for this problem is either to exchange a new key through Y, and if that doesn't work, from the perspective of A, A can only choose to leave the key of the center Y out and or not to communicate with B, which is probably a worse idea because then he cannot communicate what he wanted.
Okay. I have the feeling you are looking for the following protocol. Assume A and B got key values which should be the same, but A and B don't know whether they are the same. What possibilities do A and B have to test whether the keys they have are the same? Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There's a very nice protocol, and it's one of the parts in this exercise as well, that you find it. The key idea is the following. Let's assume A has a bit string, B has a bit string, they should be the same. Let's assume A and B have some channel where they can exchange messages. And I still assume, for simplicity in the argument, that this channel is authentic. Otherwise, still it gets more complicated. How do you build an authentic channel in a situation where you're just not sure whether your key is the same? Okay. Let's assume the channel is authentic for the moment. Then you can do the following. One of the two generates a random number, same length as the key, and sends this random number to the other participant. And now we do the following game. Whenever this random number has a 1, we are adding up the corresponding bit in the key. That is, exchanging this random number just means choose a set of half the bits within the key randomly. Add them up more to 2 and give me the result. I would argue that if Y is going to give different values to A and B, and then A and B are choosing this random number, adding up mod 2, the corresponding bits in the key, then exchanging this mod 2 sum. This protocol catches any different value K2 distributed by Y with probability 1/2. Of course, it's shortening the key, the secret key, by 1 bit, because it gives away 1 bit of information about the key. So in practice, let's assume we are exchanging really a long key, let's say 300 bits, then maybe we are exchanging this protocol 30 times. And if A and B have the feeling, okay, we didn't come up with the difference, then with overwhelming probability, the two keys are the same. And only then I would use this part of the key, possibly combined with others, to protect the message. And now again, it gets difficult how to do the authentication. And now maybe we could argue that we could authenticate, or do we need authentication at all? Maybe even that if you look closer at this protocol, that you could argue that even if the attacker is able to change No, it doesn't work. We need some kind of authentication, because the attacker knows the key value here and the key value here, because it's Y being the attacker. So in some sense, A and B need an authenticated channel, not relying on this key, because this key, both different values, are known by Y. Therefore, if you now go for a practical protocol, probably we should use K1 and K3 as the keys for establishing this kind of authenticated channel.
Yeah.
Okay. Again, I'm not sure whether I have it in the exemplary solution because I didn't read it for years. Because if you have the feeling you have your solution in your head, then you don't read it again. But my feeling is I didn't discuss that in the exemplary solution, so this was more information now than you find. And I'm not sure whether ever I thought about that in my life. So you see, now we are starting to generate new information, which when I was a student made me happy because I had the feeling, okay, now it gets really interesting. I always was frustrated by some of the exercises in the mathematics field because always they gave me the impression they already know all the answers, so this is boring for me. Okay, it's me. Okay? So many, many questions. Okay, we start in the back.
Well, about what you just said, how do the participants know which of the key exchange centers is a bad one? They have to just try out the different keys. Well, I think they had to exchange them using in each case the other two keys.
So, what we have now, our protocol we now have is, if A and B assume we both are honest, then they have a protocol to find out which of the centers are not honest. But the assumption is A and B behave properly. They are honest. And this was the base of my explanation of the protocol. Of course, B could behave in a way that trying to shed suspicion on Y. So this kind of argument that in a distributed system with three parties without digital signatures, none of the parties can find out who of the three is cheating. This problem, which is closely related to the buzzword Byzantine agreement, still stays there. It's not solvable. But if A and B trust each other, then they can find out who was cheating.
And it is pretty, pretty kind of useless to think if B is against A, because B knows all the keys and there would be no, yes, he could.
Usually, and you know that from politics, as I was educated as a child, I learned, hey, if you want to achieve this, do it in a straight way. And if people get older, they learn that many things you want to achieve, you can't achieve in a straight way. And then people either give up or they make the rules more complicated. I cannot achieve it in a straight way, but I can achieve it indirectly. And the same in security. If I have here a protocol which tells me, as a key exchange center, I cannot really attack, assuming if all the participants are honest. If I'm running one of the centers and I want to attack successfully, and by the way, it's the mission of NSA to attack. If they don't try it, okay, then we could get rid of them. So everybody likes his workplace. So It's their mission. So what will they do? They will make sure that some normal participants will be attacking and fooling all the time other people. And therefore, an assumption that A and B are both honest in practice is a very daring assumption. So they try to achieve it indirectly. And this is the normal course of life. So what I want to make sure, and we are still discussing about key exchange. Symmetry, okay. Here, we really did know about the systems. We could argue about the security of the systems. No assumptions about computational capabilities. But maybe a lot of assumptions about no modifying attacks. A lot of assumption that you know who are the good guys, because you can't check, or it's really difficult to check whether your trust has been justified. Or if you do your checks, you only can do the checks on the assumption that some of the other entities within the system work with you to find out who was cheating. And then we had your feeling in the beginning that you just said, hey, I feel better if you do it asymmetrically. And I ask you, hey, can you give arguments? And in the beginning, we hadn't many arguments. And now you see, we get more and more arguments. But still, the risky thing is, hey, we don't have any proof of security for the asymmetric systems. Would be very nice if we had, but we haven't. Okay. So, please, one person behind you, so if you pass back the mic, one step. Thank you.
Test. Okay.
Yes, works.
So, I think there's still a problem. If we don't know which key exchange center is the bad guy, so we have to test all the keys. Let's say we take key one, encrypt it with key 2 and key 3, and we have to do it with all the keys. So key 2 encrypt with 1, 3, and 3 with 1 and 2. So for the example, let's say that exchange center Z is the bad guy. Didn't we have to make out an order in which we send this encrypted messages from A to B? So for example, we could start with key 1 encrypted, key 2 encrypted, key 3 encrypted, or the reverse order, and the other participant has to know which one comes first.
Yes. I think there are two possibilities. One is we agree about the protocols in the very beginning, and then it's sorted out how it's going to happen. Or if I'm going to explain protocols, usually I say, oh, it happens this and that in that phase, and then the two participants A and B do the following. So in my explanation, usually I assume that A and B are much more interactive. If you are going to build systems, you try to fix these things as early as possible. To explain it to you, usually this more interactive approach that you think, oh, how could we do it? And pretending we decided later on during the run of the protocol is, let's say, the better way to explain it. But in practice, what you can decide ahead, usually you do. It saves you sending additional messages. It makes the protocol faster. So let's say we have some kind of emergency here. Now, first we try to figure out and start a discussion. According to which protocol are we now, hey, it's an emergency, going to exchange authenticated messages? How do we do it? Okay, the emergency will be over before we get at a solution, how to arrange, how we proceed. So usually, and this is something I don't mention, A and B want to exchange a message. Maybe there are some time restrictions when this message has to arrive. So that is, we are not interested in a protocol which now needs a lot of messages to exchange or keeps all the kind of flexibility. We want to have a protocol which is going to solve it fast as possible. And therefore in practice, usually things are decided statically in the design phase of the protocol and fixed there. Okay, right? So then I think there was a few people. Okay.
I would do it in another way. There are possibilities to show knowledge without revealing this knowledge. For example, do exchange hash sums of the keys or something like this, and looking if these hash sums are equal. And I think therefore you don't need an special secured channel or something like this.
First, even if you are exchanging hash sums, someone in between A and B, let's assume they have the same key, let's assume they arrive at the same hash. If there's a modifying attacker in between of the two, we'll just change some bits in the hash, giving A and B the impression they have different keys, in spite of they having the same key. So still, even with hash sums, you would need some kind of authentication. Second argument, with your hash functions, you're assuming some properties of hash functions which you can't prove without very, very strong assumptions again. One of your assumptions will be that the hash value doesn't tell you any useful information about the argument being hashed. This is something nobody can prove for the hash functions we are using today. The protocol I described, if you sit down and think about it, has properties you could really prove with the knowledge we have. I assume, or I have to admit, it's more complicated. But I try usually not to use as many cryptographic primitives as possible in a protocol, or using as strong assumptions, but using as few assumptions. So if I would like to argue, hey, we are doing it in an information theoretic setting, about without any assumptions what the attacker might calculate, then I have neither asymmetric crypto at my discretion for signing things, nor I have hash functions at my discretion. Of course, if you have hash functions, if they are digital signatures, life gets much easier. But please be aware that now you are assuming something about the computational capabilities of your attacker.
The hash functions are only was an example, and there are other possibilities to do that, I think.
I would really be interesting to hear. I see another possibility that you do exchanging something not directly, but again, some kind of secret sharing with third parties, but usually I would argue either it comes down to the protocol I just described, or mainly it will come down to some kind of asymmetric cryptography, including hash functions. So if you have a third solution where you have the feeling it really works, it's neat, please let me know. I really would be interested to hear. At the moment I have not really a feeling how it might look like.
I have to think about it further.
Okay. So, any more questions concerning part E?
Uh, your protocol was you wanted to use a random number to find out which key is wrong, which key is not the same as the other one.
Yes. So my random number was a means to select half of the qubits for being added up mode 2.
And you wanted to use an authentication channel, and to authenticate you wanted to use the other two keys.
Yes.
If I remember correctly.
This was an ad hoc proposal. I didn't.
Yes, but it doesn't work because you don't know if the other two keys are the wrong ones. You don't know which key is wrong in the beginning, I think.
Okay. Then maybe I should start with that I don't use both keys combined, but that I'm using one key to generate one authenticator and the other key to generate a second authenticator.
So
maybe this is
so two
closer to reality.
Two channels then. Okay.
Yes.
This should work, I think.
Yes. I think very good remark, yes. And now you see that figuring out seems to be a really small protocol, right? We had the feeling, hey, it's easy. But getting it really right is astonishingly difficult. And what I tried to convey to you is, hey, it's really difficult. And in some sense, it's a challenge. And the good news is, okay, you can earn money with it because it's difficult. If it would be trivial, okay, no way to earn a living from it.
But I think it could work if we add up K1 and K3 to establish an authenticated channel for checking K2. Then we will either see that the message we are transmitting to find out whether K2 is the right one, either they will tell us K2 is wrong, or the authentication. The authentication may fail, and we could have to try that for all the keys.
The problem is, at the moment, we completely discussed one entity within our system is a modifying attacker. Only one entity. But in practice, how do you know that? If we argue we are not just using three centers, but maybe 10 of them, hey, it is one entity cheating, two, three, we don't know. And now you see, and now it gets really challenging. And therefore I argue if someone starts to write a PhD thesis in this field, I still think it could be really a good idea. Okay, further questions? Okay, next issue is freshness of keys. What's the issue? Sooner or later, keys are abandoned, right? You have the feeling keys get too short, you don't want to use them anymore, maybe your operating system in the meantime was really insecure, so you assume your secret key might have made it to the outside world. Then you generate a new key, right? Maybe a new pair of keys. You exchange the key or you exchange the public key. And how do you make sure that an attacker cannot argue to someone else that your old key is still valid? How would you solve it? Please, yes.
So, one possibility could be that you always say, my key is valid for a period of time, let's say a month, and after a month I exchange a new pair. So no one could come and say in the third month, so okay, now you use this old key again.
Okay, so your argument is revocation of an old key is not really needed if you make the time frame of validity short enough. For example, you wouldn't need a procedure for a divorce if a marriage only would last for 2 weeks, right? Then everybody just could wait 2 weeks and that's it. Of course, why don't we do that in real life? Because making sure each 2 weeks that your marriage continues is not really fun, right? So, okay, now we see what's the problem in practice. So, somehow it gets expensive with the key exchange. Either you make short time intervals, you renew the validity of your key, or you exchange a new one, or still you need some kind of revocation for keys. So how to solve that? How to solve the revocation problem? Okay, there are probably two approaches to do it. I don't know who was first, just someone starts.
Maybe the old one key won't work anymore. Maybe you can say something like this, because if you have an old key and it doesn't work, you won't use it.
Yes, but let's assume it's with respect to an attacker. The attacker could break the old key. Maybe you want to send a message to me. This is the bad guy for the moment, right? Okay. He gives you the impression that my old key is the key I'm still using, so you use it, for example, for encrypting a message from me. Even if I forgot my old key, maybe then in a direct way I wouldn't be able to read the message you sent to me. If he could intercept the message, he could read it. And even more difficult, he could take my new key, re-encrypt it, and make me read it. So this is a kind of problem. So how would you make sure that you know the key you assume it, my recent key, is really my recent key? How would you do it? So not obviously you shouldn't rely solely on that person. He has a nice face, he's very friendly, he gives you kind of service, so it's nice. But you shouldn't rely solely on that person. So what to do? Okay, now he has to know what to do. Okay. So what advice would you give him?
I'm not sure, but I think it would be good that I create a message. In this message I write, okay, my the key with this message encrypted with is no longer valid. I encrypt the message with the old key, send it broadcast to our participants, and after that I delete my old key. And the participants also delete this key. Mm-hmm. Maybe sign this message and okay. So,
in abstract, the problem is I decide that I want to renew my key. And in some sense, I would like this message to spread to everyone, right? Of course, if you now start doing some calculation, if many, many millions of people are going to renew their key each year and sending a message to millions of people that they have a new key. Okay, that's spam, right? It's horrible. Nobody likes to get that kind of messages, right? So what to do? How to do it better? So probably one approach would be, if you want to send a message to me, you should ask me what the most recent key is. Of course, my answer to you, in some sense, has to be authenticated. So, but maybe you send me, in asking me your most recent keys, maybe you send me what you believe my most recent key is, and then somehow we bootstrap. So, one way to do it. The other way to do it is that because maybe I'm not answering to email while sleeping. Maybe whether I keep my laptop running while I'm sleeping, I'm not sure if I do so. And if this is fully automated, maybe my laptop could answer your query. If I think I'm not online all the time, then I need some kind of centers, at least one, where you could inquire what is my most recent key, get an answer. Maybe you get a signed message that this key has been revoked. And if I don't trust a single center, then I might use many of them. Hopefully that you use not only one of the centers, but several of them. So this is mainly the way to go. Okay, so probably we should now agree to some rules. So to revoke a key, probably I would argue it needs a signature of the holder of the key. Otherwise, key centers could revoke keys at their discretion, generate new keys, etc., etc., etc. And secondly, and now I'm using the asymmetric cryptography for making key exchange more robust. And usually the new key of mine should be authenticated with my old key. So hopefully I'm, let's say, changing keys early enough so the old key hopefully isn't fully insecure. If I don't succeed, then mainly I have to go physically to the center and do some manual authentication of my new key. So then it comes down to a fully new key registration or anything in between. So if you are asking that person, now you are a key server or something like that, for my most recent key, you know, maybe an older one, she will give to you first revocation statements of all my old keys. So you know the old keys are not used because you see my signature. Of course, if it's in the meantime got so insecure that she could forge my signature of revoking the key, it wouldn't be a problem if she forged it, because it's so insecure anyway. So forging signatures to revoke keys is not really dramatic. It would be dramatic if she could sign a statement, hey, this key was intended for use for 3 years, and now we decide to use it for another 30 years signature. This wouldn't be a good idea. Okay. Then she will give you the most recent key with at least two signatures. One is my most recent signature. So if you trust that my old key is not broken, then you can rely on that signature and you know this is a more recent key of mine. And secondly, she will sign that key. And she needs some reason why she signs it. Maybe it was just a normal procedure that we renewed all the keys. Then she surely will sign it without me showing up again with her. If the message is, hey, my computer got completely hacked, here's my new key, then she will probably say, hey, if your computer has been completely hacked, why should I believe you that the signature you append is not made by someone else? So please show up. We do it in writing, and only then I'm willing to sign it. So this is the kind of procedure we need. And again, you see, really working out the protocol in an appropriate way, in a sense that not in all cases I have to travel. But if it's needed, she has to insist that I'm traveling. Or maybe, now we get into shades of gray. Maybe I say, hey, my computer is broken, has been broken into. This is my new key. But it will take me 3 weeks until I have time to travel to you. But still, this is my new key. After 1 week you are asking, then probably she should sign, hey, I heard or I have some reason to believe that this will be the future key. But I can't certify that with absolute certainty. So now you get some kind of key certification, not in black and white, but in different shades of gray. And again, this is a decision how you build your infrastructure. My feeling is, whenever someone tells you, this is completely white or this is completely black, I always get suspicious. Mainly in real life, it's different shades of gray. So, okay. And this again is something which most common key exchange protocols don't have. They just do it in a black and white fashion. So what will she do? Probably she should insist that I come. And in practice, what will she do? She will ask me for a higher fee if she's going to sign it remotely. So she will buy some insurance in case you are going to sue her. And she will sign it if she's forced to do it in a black and white fashion. And now, of course, it depends on what are we using that infrastructure for. If it's an infrastructure only used for things we can buy for money, then having an insurance may be okay. If it's a thing about giving a picture of our personality in public, some issue of ethics or privacy, there are many things in life you can't buy for money. I would say, I'm lucky that you can't buy it for money. You can't buy love for money. But maybe a different or a wrong key and insecurity can kill love. And then it's really hard to get it back. Okay, so it depends on the application. Okay, any more questions concerning part F? Except you do it early enough. For example, let's assume we have some particular key length. And let's assume we are working on a security level saying that you can't break the cryptography without investing billions of euros into a supercomputer. Then we can see doing or using the public knowledge about algorithmics, the public knowledge about computing power, when your current key length gets close to this threshold, gets close to this kind of multi-billion borderline. And before that, you decide you are changing your key, you upgrade to a longer key length. And if you do that, let's say, 1 year ahead, then there's still 1 year time where everybody can check your signature because nobody could falsify it. So then you can save your travel. Of course, if it's about your computer, you assume your computer has been hacked, okay, then you have to travel. And this is one of the reasons why I have the feeling that people at the moment don't really think about security of exchanging keys, because they have the feeling each week or two we have to start from scratch anyway, because there's the next security update of our operating system. So the kind of seriousness I take in discussing key exchange mainly makes sense if you're going to trust your computer. I know at the moment every reasonable person is suspicious against his or her computer, for good reasons. But let's assume the operating system people get better, hopefully. The application programmers get better, hopefully. Then what is then expected from the crypto people? And this is what I'm discussing. Okay, then I think there was still a question. Yes, you.
I was just wondering, because of this key exchange, after a certain time the key is no longer valid and so on. What is if the key has some kind of counter that after 10 encryptions, for example, the key destroys itself? What could that be?
Of course, you can try to do anything in life. My feeling is that for today's cryptographic systems, their lifetime is not mainly given by how many times did you use them. This could be an interesting parameter if you say, hey, they have to stand an active attack with 10 phases, then after 10 interactions you do a full stop, just as you described. But to the best of my knowing, this is not the case. Nobody uses systems which have that kind of property. What we have in practice is complexity theoretic systems, where we have the feeling that if computing power or algorithmic knowledge increases, then sooner or later it's going to get a problem. Or we are using information theoretically secure systems, then if you are storing the key for a very long time on your computer, then the risk is increasing that someone got into a position making a copy of that key. So mainly it's not the number of uses but the time which counts, and this was the assumption I had in my head when doing my argumentation. But again, it's good that your question makes that assumption explicit, because what we have to do is being explicit about the assumptions we make. Okay. Any more questions? Until now, mainly we discussed key exchange in a black and white fashion. Either we said the parties who want to exchange messages exchange keys directly, or we said there are particular key exchange centers or public key directories whose sole purpose is to help others exchanging keys. So this is black and white. Either you do it completely directly or you have dedicated entities helping in key exchange. Phil Zimmermann, which was the inventor of PGP, looked for a way in between by creating something he called an introducer concept, that is, normal participants introduce each other. That is, normal participants play the role of key distribution center in some sense for other participants. So some kind of grassroots approach. And maybe this idea is Phil Zimmermann's main contribution to the practical use of cryptography. So, let's assume there are no public key registers at the time Phil started. This was true. Be it there was not a market for it, maybe some secret services didn't like them to come into existence. So there weren't any key exchange centers or public key registers. So what would we do? Some people would meet each other and exchange public keys. And so as you have some tupa or tapa parties where you meet and exchange your secrets with respect to plastics or stuff like that, so people can meet and have a party to exchange keys. And probably Ben Kellerman, if he not already did so, will ask you to a party or invite you to a party to exchange keys. And then you have exchanged keys with, let's say, people here in this room. And some of the people within this room have exchanged keys to other people. And so hopefully you build something up which is some kind of network. Who has exchanged keys to whom, and who can, by some chain of people, be authenticated. It's pretty clear, the longer the chain gets, the less you should rely on it. If you have a common friend and your common friend tells you something, then maybe this is really information. If your friend has another friend who has, again, another friend, okay, information fades out. So does trust. Trust is not transitive. But nevertheless, this was a good starting point. Again, people have a very difficult attitude to life. I know people who would sign any key just because they have the feeling signing keys, authenticating keys, is a good idea to get cryptography into place. Nice. Some people would take it very seriously that you really have to show up in person, have to show your passport. They will really check carefully whether the picture in your passport and your appearance will be the same, so maybe if the color of your hair changed in between, they may ask that you undo that change, maybe possible or not, depending on what was the cause of this change, or maybe, okay. And if you have those people, of course, I would say you can pretty much rely on what they do. Now is the question, do we have to talk more about this? Or do you have the feeling that with this statement, starting a discussion, you could sort out and you could describe what are the advantages and disadvantages of public key cryptography with PGP or PGP-like systems compared to a strictly hierarchical approach as I described it? Any need to discuss something about that? Any questions you have? I think it was your homework, though probably you thought a little bit about it at home. Did any questions arise? Okay, so we had participants exchange keys directly, we had the hierarchical approach, and we have PGP, PGP-like systems. Do they exclude each other? Do you have to decide whether you do it strictly hierarchical or whether you do it PGP-like? Or is there some kind of synthesis? Or how do you think you could find out my public key? How would you do it? Okay, you could ask me directly. Then probably I would have to look something up and then could tell you, hey, this is my key. I don't know my key by heart. You could go maybe to my website and hopefully you find it there. And maybe there are some public key servers where you could look it up. And a public key server is pretty close to some public key register as I described it in the hierarchical fashion. So what would you assume? You can combine. So of course you could use your public key generated by PGP in a strictly hierarchical fashion if you like. You can submit it to public key centers. Make it legally binding if you like. You can use it only using the introducer concept. And you can do any combination. And as I explained, if you get to know a public key using different paths, it makes the key more trustworthy for you. If you get it authenticated in a hierarchical fashion, if you get it introduced to you by different disjoint path, then nice. Whenever you have nothing to do, whenever your computer has nothing to do, the computer might try to figure out whether there's still an additional path, how you can validate the key. Okay. From my point of view, this is all I wanted to say.
The first thing, I think, we should think about a certificate. Certification, because it's something like hierarchical way. We need some register, some people who can verify that it's right key, it's not right key. But in this case, we, as in, like understood, we don't have some register centers, and in this case, participants should sign up this maybe certificate, I don't know. Example, some document.
So in a party, for example, we could read to each other the public keys, demonstrate our passports to each other, and then everybody would digitally sign using his PGP key this relationship between our names and our public keys.
Yeah, but I don't know how this certificate can be spread, maybe between friends or something like this.
Many as we like, and we can send it around. We can put it on a server. We could do whatever we want.
Okay.
So usually the strategy is have some key signing party, and then spread the result as widely as you can. So what's the downside? So in some sense, I would argue PGP is a really cool idea. In some sense, I would argue it's a much cooler idea than the hierarchical approach. And in which sense we should say, what are the limits? What it is not achieving, what the hierarchical approach might achieve?
Or maybe the number of participants? because as I understood, every participant will sign it, and there are many signatures, maybe too many.
Okay, so in some sense the question is a question of scaling.
Yes.
So a hierarchical approach usually, nearly by definition, does scale well.
Yes.
And whether looking for path in an introduction concept, okay, at least it needs some clever algorithmics.
Okay. And the second problem might be this problem you introduced some minutes ago. When we should think about, oh, I will trust it. Some people can sign everything, and it's really a problem. And in this case, for example, we can use this system for bank account or something like this.
So I think now you addressed the main point. It's a question of accountability. If someone who does key certification professionally does it wrong, then he is liable. And probably there's not really a kind of liability in key signing parties concerning PGP. If someone does it wrong, maybe this is going to damage that person's reputation within the PGP inside group. But probably nobody will hold that person liable. So I would argue that the PGP approach is a really nice approach for confidentiality. But probably it's not a splendid good idea if you want to do legally significant statements by digital signatures. If digital signatures is just a way to protect your reputation, nice, again. But if it's about larger amounts of money, and if something goes wrong, you still have to find someone who's going to pay the bill, then probably PGP is not a really good solution. Or we would have to enhance PGP by this kind of hierarchical key certification.
But I think when we use a hierarchical way, we should pay additional money for these services, something like that.
Okay, so in some sense now you may argue it's fair. If we are using cryptography to move large amount of money, then the entities helping us to do so want to have their share, as today the bank wants to have. So it's fair, okay. So there was someone else asking a question?
There's one drawback for these web of trust ideas is when you don't know this person directly or over a few connections, for example, I might not have a path to you, but I as an attacker could just create my own key pair with your name, for example, and your email address, upload it to a public key server, and then it's really difficult for somebody who does not know you directly or via some path to see if he should use my key, which I as attacker could read then, or your key, which is then secure. So I think this is really a big problem in this case as well.
Yes, so probably if this web of trust, as it is called, is used to bind email addresses. This is what is the identity for many people in the internet. I would only argue this is some kind of identity, maybe there are more on the internet, to a public key. Then probably before really sending a sensitive message to anybody, you should try out the key with some kind of random or just test message, making sure that this message reaches the person and gets signed by the person. And maybe you even do some kind of offline communication, that is, you look up in a register, do I have a telephone number? So if it gets important for you, you should try out a second path. So, okay.
Revoking the key pretty hard.
Okay. And this is, I would argue, the second problem. The first one was accountability. And the second, somehow related problem is how to revoke the key. What's the problem? Why it is a particular problem in this kind of web of trust approach, where it is not so much of a problem in a strictly hierarchical approach?
I think that it's easier to maintain, and you have a reference once you have a hierarchical structure. Once you have this web, you don't know where your information is, you don't know who is using it, so you can't tell everybody that, or you can't easily tell everybody that it should be revoked. Mm-hmm.
So if you do it professionally, then probably you will have a few centers who have signed your key, or maybe it may be even reasonable to have just one center which did it. And if you want to revoke your key, mainly you address your revocation message to that center, and that center to spread it. In PGP, you should spread your revocation message to everybody who ever signed your key. This is surely not impossible, because it will be a finite number of people. Probably you have their email addresses. Okay, maybe in the meantime some of them died, or at least the email addresses died, but okay, so you could give it a try. But I don't know whoever did to revoke his PGP key. Still now. I did so once. Did you send an email to all people? I didn't do it as well. So in theory, it might be possible to send messages to all your introducers, to all people who co-signed your key. But in practice, I don't know whether it's really done. Okay, so these two things, I would argue, are the main disadvantages. Okay. Any more questions? Okay, then we go to 3.7. Which kind of trust is necessary for which functions of a trust center? You know, and maybe I made already some critical remarks, then that you always have to think a little bit about names. If I would call me a good guy, then probably you should get suspicious and think, hey, what reason does he have to call himself a good guy? Or if I would call me a honest person, what reason does he have to insist that he is a honest person? And if a company calls herself a trust center, then you should have all reason to ask, hey, why are they calling themselves a trust center? And even if they build a large association of the meta structure of trust centers, it gets even worse. Why do they call it that way? What does it mean? So let's have a closer look. There are different functions a so-called trust center might do. It might do key generation of symmetric keys or of pairs of asymmetric keys for participants. It might do key certification. Maybe we do a trick, then we can see it all. Yes. Good trick. key certification, that is signing the relationship between identity of some person, some organization whatsoever, and the public key. There might be some directory service, that is, you can look up for some identity whether there is a corresponding public key. Or maybe there are even several of them, and maybe there are zero of them, we don't know. Key revocation. As we already mentioned, keys might be revoked because, for example, the secret key is assumed to be compromised. And in addition, there might be some service we call timestamping service. We half an hour ago had the example that if I see that my key is going to get invalid in the sense that key length gets too short, it might be broken, and if I know it well ahead, then I can use my key, which is going to get insecure in a few years, still use it to authenticate a new public key. And of course you could do the same with respect to digital signatures. I argued in the example about keys, and now I'm going to argue about signatures. If you have a statement signed by someone, which is for you an important statement, you want to keep it as proof, and now you see, hey, Intel is building ever faster chips, and what's even more important, the mathematicians devise much faster algorithms for factoring or calculating discrete logs. The key length of the signature gets too small over the next years. What could you do? Of course, you could address the person originally signing it and say, hey, please, could you sign it again with your new key? And okay, if this person is still alive, very polite and very helpful, then this person will do. But usually people are dead, are lazy, and don't want to be bothered with old stuff, right? Still, they might be very polite people, but please don't bother me with the old statements. Okay, so many interesting things to do for the future. Please, no old stuff, right? This, at least for many of us, is a reasonable attitude. So what to do? And now we get into a timestamping service in the sense that instead of addressing the original signer, you just address a timestamping service and say, please, give me a timestamp. And this timestamp means, please sign me that at this particular date and time, you have seen this statement with that signature. So you put an envelope around it and sign it. And the advantage now is that even if it gets more insecure in the future, as long as the signature of the timestamp is secure, you can prove that it has been signed, it was in existence a long time ago. So it cannot be the case that after it got completely insecure, someone made it in the recent past. So this is what timestamps are good for. And now can we do it recursively? What do you have to do if the timestamp, the signature for the timestamp, might get invalid in the foreseeable future? Then, same procedure as last year. You just submit it for another timestamp. And then again, an envelope around it, and again a timestamp. So timestamping is a mechanism to maintain the security of digital signatures without requiring the original signer to cooperate. Okay, and this obviously is a useful service. It has to do something with revocation, because, by the way, how would we do it? What does revocation mean? Revocation means you are revoking your key, right? Does this mean you are revoking your signatures you did in the past? Should not be the case, right? How do you prove that these signatures have been done in the past before the key has been revoked? Maybe at the moment the key has been revoked, the secret key was in the wrong hands and was used to sign stuff the holder of the key never would have signed. So how do you sort that out? You should be able to prove that the signature you got had been done a long time ago, before all the kind of insecurity and revocation of key happened. So what do you do to be able to prove that? You are using a timestamping service. Whenever you get a digital signature, where you have the feeling, hey, this might be very important in the future, you submit it to a timestamping service, and you get a timestamp that at this particular date and time, you had it. And then if the key is revoked after that, this doesn't influence the validity of the signature you got if it's revoked after the timestamp. So it's your incentive to get as early a timestamp as you can get. And surely, timestamping is needed if revocation shall make sense, because you cannot argue that by revoking your key, you are automatically invalidating all statements you signed in the past. So let's assume this would be possible, then there would be a very easy way to make money. You could buy stock, and if the stock level is going to increase, nice. If it's going to decrease, then on the next day you say, hey, my computer has been compromised. Bad luck. I used, what shall I say, Windows, Mac, Linux, doesn't care. I just used an ordinary operating system. So what a pity, my computer has been compromised. So sorry, my statement of yesterday buying that stock, it wasn't me. Someone else bought that stock. So the decrease in the value of the stock, hey, it's not my problem. And now you see, if you want to be able to revoke something, then your communication partner has to be able to have a means of timestamping, of preserving the validity forever. So you can only revoke with respect to the present and future. You shouldn't be able to revoke with respect to the past. Okay, so I hope now revoking and timestamping and its their relationship is clear, right? Okay, or any questions to that? Sure. I assumed at the moment that the timestamping entity is 100% honest, right? And of course you are right. We should never do that. Let's assume that timestamping services are not 100% honest. What should we do?
Maybe use several ones?
Yes, sure. And it's pretty easy how you do it. So if you don't trust a single entity, then use several of them. Okay. So now we have the base functionalities of a so-called trust center. And now I want to ask you, what kind of trust do we need with respect to the particular functions we identified? And In a paper I wrote together with some colleagues, I made a distinction between blind trust, that is, this is trust where you can't validate whether your trust is justified, and checking trust, this is a situation where you can check whether your trust has been satisfied. For example, a statement, please give me 10 euros and I will give it back to you tomorrow. Then probably tomorrow you will be able to validate whether your trust has been justified, if you gave away 10 euros and whether you got it back. If you are asking for my password and if you promise I will only use it today, tonight I will completely forget it, so no need that you change it, then probably I won't be able to check that. So it would be blind trust. So obviously, checking trust can be, depending on the kind of relationship we have, depending on the kind of business we have, can be quite reasonable. Blind trust, I would say, hey, it's risky. At least for business, usually this is not the way you should do it. Maybe if you are talking about deep emotions, true love, or whatever you might call it, then some people might argue that blind trust might be a good idea. But even then, I would say sooner or later, your rationality will restart functioning, even if it got very emotional for the first weeks. So, okay. In the long run, I think some possibility to validate your trust is really helpful, even for emotional relationships. Okay. And now back to the functions. Key generation. This is the functionality of generating keys, handing over keys to the participant, and deleting all copies you had. So bringing the participant in the position that this is the only entity on earth having the key. Can this be implemented with blind trust? With checking trust or with blind trust only? Okay, I surely would say, hey, this is blind trust. Key certification. Can you check whether certificates are okay? I would say yes. We could make up the rule, whenever you get a certificate relating to some participant A, send that person a copy. Okay. So maybe we cannot check it perfectly, but we can check it good enough. And by the way, I don't mind if the NSA for internal use are falsifying or manipulating certificates. Inside they can do whatever they like, as long as it does never make it out to any person who knows me. Directory service, can you check whether the information in a directory is okay? Again, we could make up the rule, whenever you get from a directory any statement about anybody, send a copy to that person, and that way we check the directory. By the way, I did not say at the moment, we set up the rule that from time to time you should go to the directory and check whether the information about you is valid. Why is this not enough? Because on the usual infrastructures, in approaching a server, the server gets to know your IP address. And maybe if he did a recording of your IP address and you come back, then he will, of course, tell you the same information you agreed with that server. but maybe anybody else is giving different information. So if you want to check the server, you need really a possibility to do it anonymously or pseudonymously, without the server being in a position to see, hey, this is the same entity I had yesterday. Because if a server is going to lie, then he will try to lie consistently. This, on the other hand, is something you learned as a child. If you try to cheat your parents, what nearly everybody of us at least tried once, I assume, then you learn quite early that you should cheat consistently, right? I don't say that cheating is a good idea, but if you do it, your chances get better to succeed if you do it consistently. So, revocation. Can you check whether revocation is done? Sure. Someone could look up in the server whether your key is revoked there. Timestamping. Can you check whether the timestamp you get back has the current time and date, has a valid signature, and is an envelope around the message, including the signature, you submitted? Yes. So what did we learn? Everything was checking trust except key generation. So what would we do in practice? I would argue key generation should do the participants themselves, or more in particular, the computers of the participants should do it. Why? Because those computers, there's a need that the participant trust them anyway, so they might do key generation. And having some kind of blind trust, and that kind of devices may be unavoidable. At least it's hard to avoid. All other functions are checking trust. And all other functions, I would say, a trust sender might do, as long as it does not key generation. If it does key generation, it gets really difficult. So this is the lesson learned. Any questions to that? Okay, then we made it through the exercises and we can go back to lecturing. We already talked a few times about hybrid encryption. For example, when I got the proposal that mainly we need in the end symmetric keys, I argued that, hey, we could use asymmetric keys to exchange them, and this is called hybrid encryption, or some people call it hybrid cryptosystems. So the idea is to combine asymmetric systems for ease of key distribution. And we will use symmetric systems for efficiency, gaining a factor between 100 and 10,000, roughly, in efficiency. And this is mainly true both for software and hardware. So how do we do it? We use the asymmetric system to distribute the key for the symmetric system. So let's have a look at concealment, that is encryption. So let's assume A wants to send a message N to B. So A first needs to get the public key CB of B. Then A chooses asymmetric key K. And then A first encrypts the symmetric key K with the public key of B, and next encrypts the message N with the symmetric key K. And then it sends the two to B. B uses its secret key DB to decrypt K. That is, it takes the first part, decrypts it with DB and gets K. And then it uses K to decrypt N. That's it. That's the main idea. So what do we get? We are using the asymmetric crypto only to encrypt the key, which usually is short because nobody uses that kind of approach for the one-time pad, because this would be nonsense. Because if you would use it for the one-time pad, first it would mean that this is as long as that, so nonsense. And secondly, the security would go down, because if you encrypt your key with the public key, it reduces your security. So, okay. So this kind of cryptographic scheme is used for encryption, for symmetric encryption with relatively short keys. Relatively short means between 80 and 300 bits. So what we do with the asymmetric key, this part is short, and the second part, encrypting the message, may be long. Okay. Any questions so far? Fine. Now let's assume that B wants to reply to A. How do we do it? Of course, now you could argue then B has to get to know the public key of A, generate another symmetric key, and then encrypt this other symmetric key with the corresponding public key, and use this newly generated symmetric key to encrypt the answer to A, right? Fine, works. And probably now comes the question, why are we not reusing the key K, right? Okay. Let's take a vote. Who would reuse K? Okay. Who would not use K for the backward direction? Okay, and the majority abstains, right? Okay. What is the problem with reusing K? So we are talking about cryptographic systems, symmetric cryptographic systems, where you can in principle reuse K, right? Not a problem like the one-time pad, that you should use it only once. Let's assume B is reusing K. Does B know who originally generated K? Now you see it's a difficult problem. Because within that message here, we have no authentication. Maybe as part of the message, we have some statement, in love, you are A, or best regards, A, part of the message. but it's not cryptographically secured. Can be everybody sending that. So the problem for B is here that he has no clue who generated the key K. So maybe he answers using K, but he has no idea whether it's only A knowing key K or someone else. And therefore, I would argue that it's highly risky if in this scenario the key K is used by B. What can be done, of course, is now assume a third message. Right? This is what you wanted to ask? Right? We come to that in a minute. Let's assume we still keep the message format as it is. So I first try to make as good use as possible from what we already had before changing and enhancing it. So what we could do is, hey, so if B wants to answer, yes, full procedure using the public key, generating another key, fine. But if A is then answering again, so the third message could just use K, reuse K. Because A knows he did generate K. So A may reuse it. B shouldn't. Of course, in a fourth message, B may reuse the key K he generated for the second message. Right. Okay, so far what you can do with this key. Before we do better in security, and hence, I would first try to get it a little bit more efficient. The idea is, usually, for example, if you are talking about public key encryption for the first part using RSA, then this means the first part is at least 1,000 bits long. And some people today even would argue it should be longer than 1,000 bit. Today, people would argue it should be 2,000 bits at least. Many people will argue that 128 bits for the symmetric key in length is enough, or let's say 256. This is okay. But then, let's assume this is 2,000, this is 200. Much room is wasted if you're just encrypting asymmetrically the key. So you could put parts of your message within there. Saves you some encryption with the symmetric system, and it saves you some transmission expense. So this is some kind of efficiency improvement. If there's still room in the asymmetrically encrypted unit for the message, then put part of the message already there. Okay? And now we come to B using K. So if B is supposed also to use K, then we should append some kind of authentication. That is, we should append that A is signing, so this was a signature key of A, the relationship between the addressee B and the key K. Okay. Any questions so far? Can we use, yes, sure.
In the other slide, 72, I didn't get what is the problem of reusing K, B reusing K, because if A knows that someone else is using the key, even if B changes the key, A can just tell the third third party that B is using this key, and then the third party would be aware of all the information.
I'm not sure whether I got your point. Could you please repeat?
You said that B shouldn't use K because he...
Yes, in this scenario, B should not use K because B has no clue who generated K.
Yeah, and who else knows it, right?
Yes, and probably it's not about who did generate it. It's irrelevant. It's more about who knows it. Yes.
Yeah, but if B generates a new key and sends it to A, A knows who had this first key, so A could just forward the new key to everyone, and everyone would have access to B's message.
What I don't discuss here is, maybe you remember that we had different protection goals.
Yeah.
And we had some structure in there. And maybe I missed to explain you some property of protection goals I should have done. If you take these protection goals at the left-hand side, then usually, if you are talking, for example, about confidentiality, then what does confidentiality mean? The message content should be kept confidential. Who is interested in that, or what can be achieved? Of course, if you are sending a message to me, it's only as confidential as we both want to keep it confidential. That means this is a protection goal which can only be fulfilled if we both want to have it. And if we both, of course, master to do the encryption right, to administrate our computers in a right fashion. If you go over here, there are some protection goals where it may be enough that one person wants to achieve it. If you want to stay anonymous against me, you can do it. Even if I don't want you to stay anonymous, you can just stay anonymous. Same with integrity. To keep integrity of the message content, it can only be done if both we want to do it. Anybody of us could change somehow the message. Accountability, of course, means, hey, someone signs the message, and then the other person, by changing the message, will invalidate the digital signature. So, in some sense, what we have at the left-hand side always assumes that two parties, at least in many, many situations, that two parties are in favor of the protection goals. Whereas if you go at the right-hand side, there are situations where one party alone can do it. And now we go back to what we have here. Your statement was, if A is sending a message to B, how about the key? In the end, both of them know it, and both might keep it secret, or one of them might decide not to keep it secret, to just spread it to the world. But this is not different with this key than it is with the plain text message. So it's not an additional risk that I can spread the key if I could spread the message as well.
Yeah, I think I got the point. So the point is that maybe B doesn't create a new key because he thinks that A can spread it, but because he thinks that A may not be so careful when generating the key.
Much more fundamental. B at the moment has no clue whether the key K is generated by A at all. let's assume A encrypted with a completely wrong key. So maybe we do some drawing. So let's assume there's some intermediary we call C. So maybe we have A, C, and B. So maybe A encrypted with CC, key prime, and a message key prime N. This entity knows the corresponding key. It can recover key prime. It generates a key K and encrypts for B such that it's using CB. It encrypts K and KN. Now if B would use it, the key K and the way back, C would be in a position to read the message. If, as I suggested, in the backward path, B is going to use the identity of A, so it's encrypting CA with a completely different key K double prime and some message N prime, then C is out of the loop. C has no possibility to read it. And this is the kind of attack I had in mind. Okay. Yes, right. This makes the story even simpler. So, for efficiency, we can just delete it here. But the argument is the same. In your way back, use a different key. But surely, your suggestion is fine. It makes the attack more simple. Okay?
What you really signed there, which with signature A, that you have a B in there, and signing, I didn't understand.
Okay, I am signing that I am A, so it's my signature key, and that I generated K for communication with B. So I am signing in some sense a statement that I am A, I want to communicate with B using key K. So this is mainly the statement I'm signing. And if this is signed, then B may rely on that this key is used by A. And in some sense, it may also rely on that this key is only used by A with respect to B. And both, if both is the case, then it makes sense to reuse key K. Okay, authorization. Oh, no, authentication, I should call it. Encryption we have covered. Now the question is, can we do the same trick with respect to authentication? And the answer is yes, it's not so simple, but it works. Let's assume A wants to authenticate a message for B. Then, first, get the public key of B, choose a symmetric key K, and then do the following. You have your message, you calculate a MAC using K, and then you encrypt the partner B, the symmetric key K, and then you sign that B and K and A. So this was the triple I just did right on the board, and this statement and the signature you encrypt. So this is what you send. Then your partner B does the following. He decrypts to get, no, sorry, to he first he gets TA. This is part of the key distribution. Then he decrypts part, the second part here, the last part, I should say, gets the key and evidence that the key is used by A towards B. So then he tests this signature, and finally he tests whether the message and the key together form the MAC. If so, the message is considered to be authentic. What did we achieve, or what do we achieve? We achieve symmetric authentication, no asymmetric authentication. Because both A and B get to know the key K, and of course, so they could calculate the MAC. So this is only symmetric authentication. But it's pretty efficient because the message is treated by symmetric authentication. Going back, this what I described here is really done in practice. What I described here isn't done in practice. Why is this not done in practice? We had today already the buzzword. It was you had the buzzword hash function, right? How are digital signatures made in practice? You take a long message, you hash it, and then you sign the hash value. And hash functions usually are fast. That is, hash functions are usually in the same order of efficiency as calculating symmetric authentication codes. And therefore, most people just hash the message and then sign it. And most people have the feeling, and for several applications it's true, they have the feeling that having a signature, having an asymmetric authentication is better than having only symmetric authentication. For many situations, it's indeed better. But please remember, for some situations, it's less good. So then asymmetric authentication is too much. Remember, assume all emails politicians exchange with each other are authenticated. For what purpose? Okay, you don't want to give the opposition a possibility to confuse your friends from the other party. Okay, so it should be authenticated. But it would be an absolute nightmare for politicians if they had to digitally sign all statements. Because if two politicians say, hey, we form a coalition against a third politician, usually within our own party, then this third person should never ever get proof that these two form a coalition. In particular, none of the two should be in a position to approach the third person and say, hey, that other person would be willing to form a coalition with me against you. So you see? So for some situations, digital signatures, meaning asymmetric authentication, it's not what we want. And for that particular purpose, something like that might prove to be useful. in a situation where you did manage to exchange asymmetric keys, but still you want to have symmetric authentication. Any questions so far? Okay, then I assume this is what we did today. So enjoy the day, enjoy your week, and enjoy your exercises. See you.